This is Rick Morrison, and you are listening to Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of note in central Iowa. Welcome. Today, we're featuring Nicholas Johnson. He spoke in honor of KHY's 3-year anniversary party, which was recorded at the First Methodist Church in Ames on August 23, 2015. We thank those who were able to attend and donate to help support KHY Radio. We now start with Veronica Fowler, who introduced Nicholas Johnson on stage. Veronica Fowler is the Communications Director for the ACLU of Iowa. She is also an Iowa State alumni and a 30-year resident in Ames, Iowa. She was also a reporter for the Des Moines Register and has done extensive work for TV and radio herself, as well as Fortune 500 companies, various national magazines, and websites. Here now is Veronica Fowler.
I don't think I've ever been up on an altar before. This is a strange feeling, but a nice one. Anyway, thank you so much for being here today, and I'm very, very pleased to have the privilege of introducing Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson is now at the University of Iowa College of Law, but he's perhaps best known as being a former commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, from 1966 to 1973, which, as you know, we had President Nixon as our administration leader at that time, so that had to be fairly interesting. He has been for decades a leader in the media reform movement, and his rallying cry has been, whatever your first priority is, everyone's second priority should be media reform. So keep that in mind as he inspires us today. It's appropriate that at this anniversary celebration, he's going to be talking about the origins and the future of radio. In discussing the role of community media in today's ever-changing communications landscape, he brings a longtime insider's insights on national policy and decision-making from the perspective of a long and distinguished career in the national conversation about media. He was FCC commissioner for 7 years. It was often tumultuous, and he was anything but a rubber-stamping bureaucrat. He was a rabble-rouser who affected a lot of some of the changes that we see in media today. Some of the progress that's been made with public television, more responsible programming, and many other things. And if you need proof of the sort of maverick FCC commissioner that he was, he is the only FCC commissioner ever featured on the cover of Rolling Stone. In 1970, he wrote the book, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set, which became something of a Bible for the media reform movement, really the sort of opening rounds of that conversation in a very national way. It presented prototypes for things like community media, of course, which KHOI would be part of, and advocated for community voice and influence in mass media. He is an Iowa native. He was born in Iowa City and raised in Iowa, and he returned here in 1980. He now teaches at the University of Iowa College of Law, and his emphasis is on communications and internet law. He is an active blogger, and he has posted more than 1,000 essays since 2006, and he continues to advocate for the reform of mass media. And I didn't ask him if he has a Twitter account, but if he does, he does, and so he should. I hope you share that with us all. So thank you so much, Mr. Johnson.
Well, thank you, Veronica, who's taking care of our civil rights here in Iowa, amongst a great many other things. And thanks to Ursula, who I worked with some years ago with regard to low-power radio stations, and who actually extended the invitation to me to be with you today, which I'm very happy to be. I thank all of you for coming, and to the Iowa City Group, which is starting a station, KICI. Holly Hart has been heading that up, and Craig Jarvie and Calvin Goodlaxon are with us here today. Also here is my wife, Mary Vasey, who has been mentioned and is the only family member who has actually owned and operated a relatively low-power, daytime-only, however commercial, station in a small town in Utah. So if you have any questions requiring expertise, I'm simply going to hand them over to Mary. And so Mary's here, my daughter Julie from Des Moines, and my granddaughter Laura, and her husband, my favorite son-in-law, I can say, or grandson-in-law, Francisco. So this is a family event as well. That's the family side of the church for this particular ceremony. This is an incredible accomplishment. I'm not sure if those of you here affiliated with this station and fans of it are aware of the fact. I read in Forbes recently that something like 80% of all the businesses that start up, profit, nonprofit, whatever, 80% have gone belly up after 18 months. You've been around for 3 years. You are in the top 20% of American enterprise. I think that's an extraordinary accomplishment in just 3 years. Yes. Give yourselves a hand for that. Now, as a... Actually, I've retired, Veronica. I still have my office. But once I turned 80, I decided I would rather walk out of the classroom than to be carried out in a box. But I have kept my office. I still go over there regularly. But that's what I was doing. I was teaching most recently cyber law. And as such, the reason for the stopwatch is that I am used to speaking for entire semesters at a time. And in preparing for this, I began writing up some material, which ultimately became 21 single-spaced pages with 73 footnotes. And for anyone who would like to explore these topics further, I will give you where you can find that after this talk is over. But Mary, always wise in such matters, suggested that perhaps it would be best if I never looked at that text again after reading portions of it to her. So I don't know where it is right now, but it's not on this music stand. Many presidents start off the State of the Union message by saying, "The State of the Union is good." And so I say to you, the state of radio is good. And now it's up to me to explain why, but I will do that. Radio is by definition communication. That's a 14th century word that has ties to words like commune, communitarian, the commons. And as such, communication of all kind, but particularly what we're doing with these low-power stations, is a major building block in trying to build the social capital that supports a civic society. That's really what this is about. And so I think it's no coincidence when one looks at your website and discovers that your mission is, quote, building community through communication. Your vision includes the enrichment of our community, and that one of your goals is to, quote, be a communications clearinghouse for community issues. That's what you're about. Indeed, the single takeaway from this afternoon, if you'd like to know the conclusion ahead of time and then not have to work so hard, is that KHOI and Iowa City's KICI, to come soon, is that this low-power, locally-focused radio has been a consistent purpose and presence in America's broadcasting from its very beginning until today, and has never been more needed than it is now. That's kind of the bottom line. For 50,000 years, our species has been trying to figure out ways to communicate over distance. Everything from the Pony Express to Federal Express, drums, smoke signals, you name it. But nothing has ever come along as good as radio. This invisible electromagnetic energy that is capable of carrying whatever information we can embed in it and send along with it at 186,000 miles a second. You only have to look around and think a moment to realize the extent of the burden that radio is bearing. Your TV remote is a television, is a radio transmitter. Your garage door opener is a radio receiver. Your Wi-Fi is provided by radio. Drones are piloted from thousands of miles away by radio. Cars will soon be talking to each other by radio. And the spacecraft that recently sent back to Earth over 5 billion miles photos of Pluto used radio for that task. Soon, our internet that now connects 3 billion people is becoming an internet of things, projected soon to be an internet that connects some 25 to 75 billion things using radio. That's right. So the state of radio, certainly as a technology, is not only good, it's excellent, it's spectacular. Radio is king. And it's not as likely to be knocked out as some other technologies. What happened to the Swiss watchmakers with digital watches? What happened to the slide rule industry with the hand calculators? IBM's almost totally missing the market for desktop and laptop computers. And I think we're also often unaware of the role that the telegraph has played in all of this. The relation of Morse code, which consisted of long and then short bursts of static, basically, is an analogy for what we now do with digital transmission, which is sending higher and lower voltage in ways that enable us to create a numerical system based on 2 rather than 10, assigning numbers to letters, and thereby also transmitting information along with electromagnetic energy. That's one way in which telegraph is relevant to radio. Another is that it was early used from the middle of the 19th century for transmission of news to newspapers. So it was a predecessor in that sense. And finally, there is the matter of naming. Names do make a difference. Shakespeare had Juliet in Romeo and Juliet say that a rose by any other name would smell the same. And Gertrude Stein said, a rose is a rose is a rose. But a very wise fellow observed, a rose by any other name might never, never smell the same. And canny is a nose that knows an onion that's been called a rose. Marconi's radio transmitted static, as I've explained, that could be turned into Morse code transmissions, but no voice and no music. Nobody knew exactly what this thing was. There was no analogy. There was no way to name it. We didn't have a vocabulary for it. You may recall back some years ago that Steve Martin and Bill Murray in Saturday Night Live had a routine where they would stand there as a kind of country bumpkins and pointing off in the distance and saying, what the hell is that? So there's somebody who's a Saturday Night Live fan. So that was the situation we were in. Nobody knew exactly what this was, and that was a century ago for radio. Now, how many of you have ever had grandparents explain to you what the first words were that we used to describe the new automobiles? Anybody here know? Significant in this context? Yeah. Horseless carriage. Why was that? Because farmers came to Nevada, the county seat, on Saturday night in carriages drawn by horses. And lo and behold, here was a carriage no one understood, but it had no horses. Where are the horses? It's a horseless carriage. Now, how do you suppose that might have affected the early naming of radio? Anyone have what? The wireless. Another contribution of the telegraph to KHOI. Telegraphy used wires, first by Sam Morse from Washington to Baltimore with the message, "What hath God wrought?" And so here seemed to be an ability to send telegraphy without using wires, and so it was named wireless telegraphy. But look what that does to your head and how you perceive it. No one calling something wireless telegraphy would ever think that someday NBC, as one of the first networks, would be distributing programming to millions of American homes. But that was how it began. The radio hobbyists were the first, from sort of 1895-1915, to start up stations, originally Morse code transmission, ultimately voice and music and so forth. Your chief engineer, Paul Nelson, is an amateur radio operator, as I am, extra class N0EAJ. But it was other developments as well. AM, FM, shortwave, microwaves, now used by cell phones. The sending of photographs and then television by way of radio waves. Communication satellites. We could build a communication satellite for $50,000 that cost the NASA $100 million and toss it up there as a low Earth orbiting satellite long before anybody else was doing that. Single sideband to save on frequency. The predecessor of cell phones, and even bouncing signals off the moon and back to Earth as a way of communicating. You may have heard of Rockwell Collins. The Collins in Rockwell Collins was Arthur Collins, a radio amateur who started what is now one of America's largest corporations. Radio amateurs observed that a vertical antenna transmits equally poorly in all directions. And that is not very good if you're trying to send confidential messages by Morse code from shore to a cruise ship where a multimillionaire billionaire is taking a trip and telling him about what happened to the stock market last week. Because everybody within the diameter of that broadcast is going to have that information. So that's kind of a drawback, you know, unless you start thinking about, well, geez, is there anything we could come up with that maybe it would benefit from going in all directions? And the fellow who thought of that was a telegraph operator. You'd be amazed at how many of the innovators of the 19th and 20th century spent some time in their youth as telegraph operators. Andrew Carnegie got the concept of a business being larger than a single factory, would go to China and keep in touch with all the elements of his enterprise by cables sent by Morse code. This young telegraph operator was David Sarnoff, who happened to have his hand on the key, his fist as we call it, the night the Titanic went down, which made him something of a national hero, brought him into RCA at this young age. And he went to his bosses and he said, "I got a business plan for you." Now, it used to be the business plan was you give away the razor and you sell the blades, right? He said, "What if we turn that, you make your profit on the blades, right?" So he says, "What if we turn that around? What if we sell the razor and give away the blades?" And he said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "We can sell millions of Americans," and his projections in his business plan came very true, over year one, two, three, four. We can sell these radio receivers to the American people, but they have to have something to listen to on the radio. If we create the programming and put it out on this antenna that sends out the signal equally poorly in all directions, they can pick up our programming, and the word will spread, and everybody will want one of our radios. And no American business person has ever been more correct than that. At that time, there was no meaningful regulation of radio in this sense. There was a Radio Act of 1912, but it primarily related to ship-to-shore, to wireless telegraphy, and did not contemplate it. Nonetheless, it gave the power to that great Iowa radical of the time, Herbert Hoover, who was then... God, you're a tough crowd. Herbert Hoover was then Secretary of Commerce. It was before he became President of the United States. There's a little museum about him in West Branch, if you're ever down that way. Anyhow, he had authority under the 1912 Act to grant licenses, ostensibly for ship-to-shore and that sort of thing, but also started granting licenses to radio amateurs. Problem was, he had no power under the Act to deny anybody a license. All that was contemplated was that there would be licenses. At that time, the amateurs had some 8,500 licenses, and by 1927, there were over 700 radio stations broadcasting programming, many of which had been initially developed by amateurs but might be owned by others in 1927. But less than 100 of them had network affiliation. So at that time, what we had as radio is very similar to what you are doing with your station. These were relatively low-power stations in relatively small towns, much smaller than Ames is now, that were of necessity putting out local programming because there wasn't anything else. But they were also mindful of the purpose that that served and why that was desirable. Those are some of your station's ancestors. Those early 8,500 amateur radio stations, those 700 plus broadcasting stations putting out programming and music and speech and so forth.
You are listening to Nicholas Johnson, who is Iowa's own former FCC commissioner and media reformer. He spoke at the First Methodist Church here in Ames on August 23rd during our three-year anniversary party. Now back to Nicholas Johnson.
Note that the industry wanted Herbert Hoover to abolish those low-power stations, and he refused to do it. So that's something you owe Herbert Hoover, if nothing else, but you owe him other things as well, actually. But he limited them all to one frequency, 833 kilohertz, about where KXIC is in Iowa City. In the years from 1923 to 1927, there were some 31 bills introduced in the House for regulating these new stations that were dealing with programming. And by 1927, according to the great radio historian Eric Barnow, the demand for legislation was shrill. And now here comes a truly remarkable story based on what we're used to from the U.S. House of Representatives over the last few years. This shrill demand came in November and December of 1926. By February of 1927, the 1927 Radio Act had been passed through Congress, signed, and was law 2 months. And bear in mind what you had going on at that time in terms of competition, which I'll come to in a moment. It turned out that after the big four, RCA, GE, Westinghouse, and AT&T got together and created an RCA with NBC Network, which had two networks actually, the Red Network and the Blue Network, that this regulatory, which happened about the same time as the Act was passed, sadly, and the Act, which was really more addressed to mom-and-pop low-power stations in small rural communities, was no longer really well-suited to hold the forces of big business conglomerates, networks, the domination by advertisers, and so forth, what I, in an article in The Atlantic in 1968, referred to as the media barons. But even though the miracle of radio was only barely understood in 1926, there was an awareness of the risk of monopoly power and ownership. And one member of the House from Texas, Luther Johnson, no relative of mine or of Lyndon's, said, "American thought and American politics will be largely at the mercy of those who operate these stations." American thought and politics. "For publicity is the most powerful weapon that can be wielded in a republic. And when such a weapon is placed in the hands of one or a single selfish group is permitted to either tacitly or otherwise acquire ownership and dominate these broadcasting stations throughout the country, then woe be to those who dare to differ with them." Woe be to those who dare to differ with them. How prescient can you be? He concludes, "It will be impossible to compete with them in reaching the ears of the American people." Secretary Hoover said, "It would be most unfortunate if broadcasting should be controlled by any corporation, individual, or combination." And 30 years later, in 1956, Senate Commerce Committee Chairman Warren Magnuson was still warning the commission that it, quote, "should be on guard against the intrusion of big business and absentee ownership." So we've been dealing with that for a long time, but we've still maintained at least some of these local stations, both commercial and non-commercial like yours. There was an equal concern about the coming of advertising. At the time of the radio conferences that Herbert Hoover called in the 1920s, 1922, 23, 24, 25, he said, "It is inconceivable that we should allow so great a possibility for service to be drowned in advertising chatter." Can you imagine that today? But even more remarkable, the trade press, which would later attack with considerable vituperation any FCC effort that might impede their profit maximization, expressed concern that, and I quote, "Driblets of advertising, indirect but unmistakable, are floating through the ether every day. You can't miss it. The woods are full of opportunists who are restrained by no scruples when the scent of profit comes down the road." New York Democrat Saul Bloom proposed that radio advertising be outlawed by Congress. Senator Burton Wheeler likened the programming to a pawn shop. Senator James Cousins noted the, quote, "growing dissatisfaction with the present use of radio facilities." And the Federal Radio Commission's annual report declared that such benefit as is derived by advertisers must be incidental and secondary to the interest of the public. So what brought this about? Well, there came to be more network affiliates, more dependence upon network programming, so there was less time for local programming. The focus of the owners shifted from that of hobbyists or these early stations to potential profits, corporate ownership, the political power they gain by offering members of Congress free time on the local radio station to promote the member of Congress, and the general weakening of commission regulation as the political power of the industry amassed. As late as 1934, even the National Association of Broadcasters, their trade association, said, "It is the manifest duty of the broadcasting authority to review past programming." This was a real breakthrough, because prior to then, the public interest and licenses were to be given and renewed and construction permits, always against the standard of the public interest, convenience, and necessity. But that only applied to engineering, that the signals would not overlap, that nobody was going to get burned on the transmitter or whatever, the power levels, that sort of thing. But with these abuses, a predecessor of mine named Clifford Durr, who was the brother-in-law to the Supreme Court justice for whom I had clerked, Hugo Black, he refused to renew some of these licenses, just as I did. And ultimately, he did an investigation that uncovered such extraordinary abuses that Paul Porter, the chairman, gave a talk to the broadcasters, not unlike Newt Minow's Vast Wasteland talk. And the commission set about putting together a report on what they expected by way of programming as distinguished from the engineering standards. And they talked about four things, sustaining programs, meaning non-commercially supported programs paid for by the station, local programming, the providing for opportunities for public discussion of issues, and the elimination of public of commercial advertising excesses. Well, as you know, to bring about any public benefit, it's not enough, speaking in a church as I am, that it be moral. You can substitute the writings of Ayn Rand for the writings found in the Gospels, and that's perfectly okay, they say. So the way you have to appeal is to say, look, you can do well by doing good. Let us explain to you how people have made more money with local programming than doing what you're doing. And they told a story in what was come to be called the Blue Book, was this report of abuses and of proposals. They told the story of a Midwest 250-watt station that had to get new management. They were going out of business. They were only producing $2,400 a month. They brought in the new management that focused exclusively. They no longer tried to compete with distant stations. They focused exclusively on local programming. Women's groups, the schools, whatever. As a result, at the end of 1 year, they were pulling in, instead of $2,400 a month, $6,000 a month. And the manager acknowledged that this was solely due to the change from this effort to entertain people with fluff to actually dealing with things that people cared about, like what you are doing. So that's another sort of example of your ancestors, is what it is the FCC was asking for in the Blue Book was similar to what radio was in 1915 to 1920, say. Now, at my time, which was 1966 to 73, station licenses were still limited to three-year terms. We had very strict limits on how many stations anybody could own, AM and FM and TV. Renewals required the presentation of a log of all the programming for what we called a composite week. It was days selected at random from the past term. They had to report quantities of commercials, number of PSAs, public service announcements, and percentages of programming devoted to news, devoted to public affairs, and what we called programming other than entertainment programming. There were some rays of hope. There were license renewal challenges. There was the beginnings of a media reform movement. Various groups, the women's movement, the African-American movement at the time, took an interest in what you've been told. I once titled a book, Your Second Priority, that whatever else they're trying to accomplish, I told them, you got to work on media reform or you don't have a prayer of accomplishing anything. And if you do work on media reform, you at least have a chance. And so that was good. But with the 1980s came Ronald Reagan's mantra, government is not the solution, government is the problem. At the FCC, as with many other agencies of government, this took the form of what they called deregulation. So pushing aside the former concern with monopoly control of media power, Congress changed the law in 1996 from a limitation of a handful of radio stations to a standard that permitted Clear Channel ultimately to own 1,225 radio stations in 300 cities and to have the largest audience share in 100 of 112 major markets. Some of us asked the CEO of one of the companies desiring to merge with others, why are you guys doing this? You know, you're making over 100% return on depreciated capital now. How much wealthier do you need to be? What's your motive? What are you trying to accomplish? And he replied very candidly. He said, listen, someday there are going to be five firms that control all the media on planet Earth. And we intend to be one of them. Pretty straightforward, right? And it's come closer and closer, obviously, to that. Today, we no longer have the Bill Paley's and David Sarnoff's and Frank Stanton's, who used to be identified as the leaders of these organizations. They had family members and friends and neighbors and folks at the country club who would talk to them and say, what were you doing putting on a show the other night? That's a bunch of trash. And they had to respond to that. And they took pride in the programming that they did. That was the other side of it. You don't have that anymore. There was a time when Apple wanted a new CEO and they took the guy who had been running the Pepsi-Cola company. The people running the media now did not grow up in publishing or in broadcasting. They went to business school and they listened to Wall Street. Wall Street said to the Los Angeles Times, you're only making a 30% profit every year. We want you to drive that up to 40%. Well, if you can't get any more subscribers and you can't get any more advertisers, you can't increase your cash flow, all you can do is cut your costs. And if your costs are all tied up in journalists, that means when you cut your costs, you fire journalists. And that's a part of what is happening to our media when it's controlled not by people who care about media, but the Wall Street bankers and hedge fund owners and so forth. There are essentially four kinds of sources of information and opinion that we need to have. One is global. American media are an abysmal failure on that one. For years, I listened to the BBC on shortwave, and then NPR, lacking programming of its own, started to carry the BBC, so I listened to it that way. Now on an iPhone, I've got Rudow to tell me what's going on in Kurdistan. I've got Le Monde to tell me what's going on in Europe. Guardian from London. You can get all this stuff available now globally from newspapers of and broadcasters of quality, so you don't need to depend on the United States. For United States news, you do, however. National news is sort of whatever happened in New York and Washington that day. Then we have regional and state news in Iowa that might be represented by the Des Moines Register, or at least it was when the Register delivered its papers to every little cafe in the state of Iowa and could truly put in its masthead the newspaper all Iowa depends upon, and ended up earning more Pulitzer Prizes than any newspaper in the United States, with the exception of the New York Times. We did at one time have that kind of regional and statewide coverage around the United States, and then we've got local coverage. Well, the national news now is a real disgrace. How many of you watch the ABC Evening News? Well, bless you one and all. And one hand in the back of the room, I am so proud of you, you have no way of knowing. But because you don't know what's there, I do request you watch it once to see how awful it is. And watch the promo that comes on before it comes on, all right, on your local ABC station. You have never heard such an effort to terrorize and frighten you about the outbreaks of terrorism, the fires, the floods, the captured, kidnapped children. Wherever there is a disaster in the world, it doesn't make any difference. It's not just limited to disasters here, because amongst the legitimate news, the disasters elsewhere all also figure. And you put a filter on, we only want disaster news. So then they announce it that way, and then comes the program itself, and they fill in the details with the gruesome pictures, and, you know, we give you a warning, this is pretty awful to look at, but you really need to see it. And that's the ABC Evening News. And nothing about what's going on in the world, nothing about what's going on that matters in America. Celebrity news, you know, whatever, all right. Indeed, it has now reached the point where John Oliver, who is a stand-up comedian, now seems to be America's most reliable source of the data and analysis needed for American citizens to address their most serious public policy challenges. How many of you watch John Oliver's weekly thing? Yeah, enough. You know what I'm talking about. And the rest of you, give a listen. I didn't mention, but, well, no, I did mention my 21-page, 73-page footnoted thing. Well, one of those footnotes lists the last eight topics that John Oliver has addressed. Every one of them deadly serious, presented in an entertaining manner that even in the podcasts gets views in the 2 million, 4 million. People are hungry for this. They want to have a way of thinking about what these problems are. You know, Bernie Sanders is great. He talks about it. But you need somebody like John Oliver to get in and really spend some time talking about how serious this is and what solutions there are. Americans want that. Now, regional and statewide news coverage has suffered from many of the same pressures that the national news and ABC has. Which now brings us, you will be pleased to know, full circle round to the role you and other local nonprofit radio stations play in today's media environment. It is, as it turns out, to where radio broadcasting began 100 years ago in 1915. And where the FCC's Blue Book was telling the broadcasters they ought to be 70 years ago. There is a there, and you are there. The state of radio is good, both as a technology and as local civic service, an endeavor that comes as close as any can to the potential for building the sense of community we so desperately need in these times. Thanks to you for the invitation. Happy birthday. And now let's party on. Thank you.
And Veronica is back. This is the best part of the show. I just appear in between like peanut butter on a two-sided sandwich.
I will now tap dance. No.
All right.
No, you can't.
Yeah, I know we're going to have a discussion maybe.
Yes. I am supposed to moderate questions. And as such, I think all I'm supposed to do is kind of tell you to start asking questions. But I get privileged because I get to ask the first one. I actually have a question you talked about. How more than ever community radio like this station is needed. But explain to me, in this exploding media landscape, never ever before has there been so much information. You know, the fire hose of information comes at us, you know, and just with the phones in our hands, we can get more information than ever before in minutes. So tell me, how does community radio fit into that? Why is that? When we're not hurting for information in any way, shape, or form, including local media, how does that fit into that? Why is it so important?
Number one, I would disagree with you about the extent to which we have access to full reporting of local news. In many communities, there's virtually none. I've watched the shrinkage in our local papers in Iowa City. Iowa City, you know, located in Johnson County, the People's Republic of Johnson County, prides itself on intellectualism and being informed, one of the United Nations' three cities of literature, and so forth. And our paper is, in its own way, somewhat similar to, it's not ABC, it's just that it's often a six-page paper. And there isn't a lot there discussing serious issues. The Gazette makes more of an effort. I think I'm a part of the Gazette writers' circle. So number one, I don't think we have. I mean, there are many communities in which there is no report, and Iowa City is one of them. There is no reporter who regularly covers the County Board of Supervisors meetings. All right, and the school board gets spotty coverage. The city council gets spotty coverage. Nobody's really dug into the way the city council takes taxpayers' money and gives it to the wealthiest people in town in the form of tips for for-profit enterprises having nothing to do with legitimate government programs. And nobody's really dug into that. So I don't think we have it. Number two, there's no substitute for radio for people who want to listen while they're on their tractor or in their workplace, working on cars or whatever, the kitchen. It's a wonderful thing to kind of follow you around while you're doing that, when you can't be reading a paper or watching television. It's in automobiles. Now, admittedly, there are ways in which you can enhance your effectiveness as a station, and you're doing much of it with podcasts and streaming so that people who don't hear it when it's originally broadcast can still get access to it. And I would note the BBC in this morning's program about 4:30 a.m. had a bit about what the BBC is doing to provide pictures of what their radio programs deal with that I guess you watch on a computer while you're maybe listening to the program. I'm not sure how it works. But the point is there's a lot more innovation that radio can do. So I think a lot of the tsunami that's washing over us, or as you say, the fire hose, it's very difficult to drink out of a fire hose. It's not difficult to listen to KHOI.
Thank you,
Julie.
So much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You've been listening to KHOI's Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of notes in Central Iowa. Today we featured Nicholas Johnson. He was Iowa's own former FCC commissioner and media reformer who spoke at the First Methodist Church in Ames on KHOI's three-year anniversary party on August 23rd. For more information, you can go to our website at khoifm.org and click on the speaker button in which you can listen to this broadcast again. If you're listening to this broadcast at noon, you can hear it again at 7 o'clock tonight here on KHY 89.1 FM. We thank those who were able to attend and donate to help support KHY here in Central Iowa. Thank you.